good morning, America, and welcome to Veterans Radio. We are so pleased to have you listening to us today. We've got a great program online. We've got Dwight Zimmerman's going to be our host today, and he's got some incredible authors. He's going to be talking about some books. But the first thing I want to address, though, and maybe some of you have heard, is that one of our partners, Vance McCrum, was in a really bad car accident on Thursday down in Ohio. He is okay. He broke a lot of bones. They said he fractured his neck, he broke his sternum, broke some ribs, lost a little piece of a finger, and so forth. What happened was that a semi-truck going eastbound on the Ohio Turnpike decided that it wanted to take a shortcut through the median and unfortunately hit another semi and then ran into Vance. And so hopefully he is recovering. So we're asking for all of you out there to send your prayers to Vance McCrum, please. If you'd like to send him a message, you can send me an email, and I will forward it to his family. That's Dale@veteransradio.net. That's Dale@veteransradio.net. And his whole family, we want to thank his son, Mike, for sending us an email and keeping us up to date as what's going on. I believe he's at the University of Toledo Hospital in Toledo, and hopefully Vance. Boy, we need you, buddy. You better make a quick recovery. I'm hoping that you'll be fine. We're hoping to get down there and see him in the next couple of days. So, again, for our audience out there, if you'd like to send a message to Vance, he's better known as the Dog Man. This is so he's a great friend and a great supporter of Veterans Radio and a great supporter of all of you out there. So we're going to pray, and pray some more that he recovers fully. So I just wanted to get that in there. We got a great program going today, and I want to welcome Dwight from our remote studios in Brooklyn, New York. Dwight, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
Good morning, Dale, and good morning, everyone. Yeah, thank you. I'm coming to you live from the Studio 4F here at Veterans Radio Network East in Brooklyn, New York, where it's raining. Yeah, we got a great program here. We're going to... My guests this morning are Jake Tapper, who's now with CNN. He was the former senior White House correspondent for ABC News. He's the author of a powerful book called The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor, a series of actions involving combat outpost Keating in Afghanistan. And my second guest is Peter Larangis, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that name correctly. He's the co-author of a young adult novel called Somebody Please Tell Me Who I Am, story of a bright high school student who, to his family's consternation, announces that he's going to enlist in the Army, and because of he has a commitment, moral commitment to serve his nation. He's wounded by an IED in Iraq, and this is the story of how he recovers. And before we get to our guests, last week, as many of you will recall, we started a little game here on At Ease. And I have a book coming up this fall, a Civil War quiz book called Test Your Civil War IQ. It's got 500-plus questions in it. And we just decided to at the beginning of the show, to ask a question, and then people call in to give us the answer. And now, to the person who provides the correct answer, I will give them an autographed copy of my number one New York Times bestseller, Lincoln's Last Days.
Which, by the way, jumping in, is an incredible story. It is a version, I guess you could say, of the Bill O'Reilly book. But I found it more fascinating than the original, Dwight.
Well, thank you, Dale. I love to hear things like that.
I know you do.
Okay, so let me ask the question. It is, when Major General A.P. Hill fought at Antietam, he was A, sick with a mild case of measles, B, a brigade commander, C, under arrest, or D, fighting on foot because his horse had been shot out from under him. Again, A, sick with a mild case of measles, B, a brigade commander, C, under arrest, or D, fighting on foot because his horse had been shot out from under him.
And what was that general's name again?
A.P. Hill.
A.P. Hill. And this was at Antietam,
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. Well, folks out there, you got to give us a call, so I guess I better give you the number. It is 877-573-7825. That's 877-573-7825 to get your free autographed copy from Dwight, and I think you're going to really enjoy the book. So right now, we're going to go into our first break, and when we come back, we're going to bring Dwight back with his first guest, who is Jake Tapper, and I'm anxious to hear about that one. That book was fascinating. So right now, you're listening to Veterans Radio, and we will be right back after this message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
And we're back on Veterans Radio, and we're going back again live to Brooklyn, New York. And, Dwight, you're on.
Thank you, Dale. So my first guest this morning is Jake Tapper, the author of this powerful and actually in many respects infuriating book, but I mean that in a good way, The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor. Jake, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Great. Yes, I can hear you just fine. Thank you for being here on At Ease. Greatly appreciated.
My pleasure. I'm actually not far from you if you're in Brooklyn, because I'm at LaGuardia right now.
Oh, yes, that's right. You're about to board an airplane. So, well, you've been a quite busy man here. So let's just jump right in here and give us a quick summary of The Outpost.
The Outpost is about one very vulnerable combat outpost that was built in 2006, about 14 miles from the Pakistan border in eastern Afghanistan, and was on the morning of October 3rd, 2009, attacked by overwhelming Taliban forces. So overwhelming, and they all had the high ground because the outpost was built at the bottom of three steep mountains, that many of the 53 U.S. troops in the outpost that day did not know if they were going to survive the attack, and in fact, many did not. It's a true story of the men and women who served at that outpost from 2006 through 2009, and it's a way for people who don't feel completely connected to the war in Afghanistan or don't fully understand what our troops exactly might be doing over there. It's a way for people to understand, and it's a way for people to honor the service of those who have served, and also their families, who, as we know, go through a lot themselves.
This is a really thick, you know, huge book, more than 600 pages. You did really extensive research and interview work here. I was very impressed with it.
Oh, thanks. I've never worked longer or harder on any professional project in my life. I interviewed more than 225 people, ranging from privates to generals to people in the White House to, in some cases, even insurgents. I devoted more than, you know, about 2.5 years of my life to this project, and I hope it pays off. I think it does.
Well, I have to say that you have a big fan for the book, you know, in me. I found it, as I said earlier, to be absolutely infuriating at times, but it was more because of what you were telling about how everything got set up, you know, the whole purpose for placing Combat Outpost Keating where it was, you know, the rationale, which I found to be very flawed to begin with, and I'm a civilian, having never served, but it looked like you're literally setting these people up to be shot at.
Well, there are a lot of men who served there who their first reaction to arriving at the outpost and looking up at the three mountains that surrounded the camp was disbelief, and you're not the only one to be infuriated by the decisions that led to the placement of the outpost there, and perhaps even more so, continuing to keep the camp there, even after it was clear that it was dangerous, and there were times where various commanders tried to shut the outpost down, and they were not able to, or it just didn't make sense. And one of the important points for your listeners to keep in mind is one of the reasons why the outpost was put where it was, and one of the reasons why it was kept where it was, had to do directly with decisions made at the Pentagon and the White House, which is to say, when you don't send enough helicopters to serve a mission, then decisions have to be made accordingly. So one of the reasons that the outpost was put where it was put was because it had to be near the road in order to resupply the camp. Because there were not enough helicopters, they would not be able to resupply it if it was on the top of a mountain. And in this part of the country, at the base of the Hindu Kush mountain range, one is either on a mountain or in a valley. So in order to put the camp somewhere, they had to put it near the road because they needed to be able to resupply it. That's a direct decision, a direct consequence to not having enough helicopters in Afghanistan at the time. And the same decision, the same thing affected decisions made throughout the lifespan of the outpost, that it would be too difficult to close it down because they would need helicopters that were not available.
Yes, and in point of fact, one of the contributing factors for the problem there was, as you explained very well, there were insufficient forces in Afghanistan at the time, so they were stretched thin everywhere.
Very thin. Well, that was one of the reasons why then-Colonel, now-General Mick Nicholson set up all these small outposts in eastern Afghanistan, was because, amazingly, the U.S. had not really pushed to any significant degree into that part of the country, even though that's the part of the country where bin Laden escaped and where he lived for a time near Jalalabad in the late 90s. But the U.S. was really only starting to establish a presence in 2006. In 2007, there were literally 20 times the number of U.S. troops in Iraq as there were in Afghanistan, 20 times. And so the idea that, this was infuriating to a lot of the troops who served there because, they wanted to do the job, they wanted to do the mission, but for whatever reason, they did not feel like they were given what they needed to do.
Now, the decision to actually shut down Keating was made in December, but was not acted upon until the following October, which is really...
That's right.
Yeah. Explain why there was such a delay.
Well, so the colonel and lieutenant colonel who were pushing in to that part of the country and taking over in 2009 had been looking at combat outpost Keating, and they had decided that it was not serving any purpose other than defending itself. That's all it was doing. It was not achieving anything in the larger mission in Afghanistan. So they were also very, very worried about how vulnerable that camp was, as well as a number of other camps in that area. So they had a proposal to close down about five camps, five of these little outposts, and consolidate U.S. forces in a different part of that area, and they thought that would be a better way to wage the war in that little corner of it. They brought the plan to General Stanley McChrystal, who was in charge of U.S. forces in Afghanistan at the time, in 2009. And for a number of reasons, McChrystal did not think it was a good idea to do it. Some of the reasons were resource decisions. They were fighting north of combat outpost Keating, and the helicopters were devoted to that. And some of the decisions were political decisions, namely, the Afghan election of August 2009 was coming up, and Afghan President Karzai did not want the U.S. closing any bases. He wanted votes from those areas, and he didn't want to signal weakness. He thought that would symbolize weakness if the U.S. was withdrawing. And McChrystal was inclined to do what Karzai wanted him to do. And then also, McChrystal was involved in a kind of messy back and forth with President Obama in the White House about troop levels. And at that point, McChrystal was being deferential, and Obama had taken control of the debate, and he was meeting regularly with his war council to talk about the future of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And at that point, McChrystal told Colonel Randy George, who was proposing closing the camp, "I don't want to get ahead of the president." So there were a number of reasons behind this decision to not close the camp when Colonel George and Lieutenant Colonel Brown wanted to. But ultimately, it can be argued that those decisions cost 8 American troops their lives, the 8 Americans who were killed that day.
Yes. Now, I see you have a Facebook site for the Outpost. Where can our listeners get the book?
Well, it's available on Amazon. It's available at Barnes & Noble. It should be out in bookstores. But Amazon and Barnes & Noble have seem to have good supply now. You're right, there's a Facebook site for the Outpost. It's just facebook.com/outpostbook. It's a way that people can actually, a lot of the troops in the book and a lot of their families regularly write on that page, and they write in, so it's a place where you can thank troops if you want, or if you read the book and you want to share any thoughts either with me or with anybody who served there, that's a good forum for people. If anybody, any of your listeners buy the book, I'd love to hear what they think.
Great. Now, let's talk about the climactic event in October. Once the decision was made to take everyone out, it's like that set up a sequence of events that was, well, to be trite, bad. And ultimately, one individual there, I was amazed at how many decorations were given to the men there, including Staff Sergeant Romichet, who received is our latest Medal of Honor recipient. So please tell us about the action that day.
Well, it started at 5:58 in the morning. The hills were teeming with up to 400 Taliban insurgents and other insurgents. And it was a very well-crafted and strategic attack. I think a lot of people in the U.S. tend to think of the Taliban as backward cavemen from a different century. But the truth is, whatever you think of their ideology, they're very fierce and strategic fighters. As the soldiers who served there will acknowledge, it was a smart attack. You know, the soldiers who served there had been, you know, to pass the time, talking for months about how they would attack the camp if they were the Taliban. And in many ways, the Taliban attacked it exactly that way, which is overwhelming force, all from the high ground. They focused initially on shutting down any the two main ways the outpost had to defend itself. One, the observation post up in the mountains. Two, the mortar pit where the big guns were that could reach up in the mountains and get the Taliban most effectively. They focused so much intense fire on those two places, killing a mortar man right off the bat, that it became impossible for the mortar pit for the entire time of the battle and for the observation post for much of the initial assault to do anything to help to protect the men at the camp. And then the Taliban they had snipers, they had RPGs, they had mortars, and they just were unrelenting in their attack on the men. And it was just in the first few minutes that three guys were killed, three Americans were killed. There were a number of Americans trapped in a Humvee, five of them were trapped in a Humvee. Of those five, only two survived. There was a mission, a lot of bravery, a lot of valor. You mentioned Clint Romichet, the staff sergeant, who was just awarded the Medal of Honor. He is one of many, many men that day who ran into harm's way to try to save his brothers. And all eight of the men who died in an act of selflessness. All eight of them died trying to save a brother, trying to deliver ammunition, trying to return fire, trying to rescue a friend. And it is a tragic and infuriating story, as you suggest, but it's also in some ways an inspiring one, I think, because we do have people like this serving for us in the armed forces, people who are dedicated to their brothers in arms. And ultimately, by the end of the day, because of air support and because of valorous action by so many U.S. troops, the U.S. was able to beat back the Taliban, and 8 Americans were killed, and it was very tragic, but 45 Americans survived. And then a couple days later, the U.S. abandoned the camp and bombed it.
Yes. Now, there were, in addition to U.S. troops, there were a couple from our NATO allies, but also there were some Afghan National Army troops there. What did they do during that action?
One of the interesting things about following the lifespan of the outpost from 2006 through 2009 is seeing how different Afghan soldiers are. Like some platoons were brave and courageous, and others were not. Unfortunately, the troops that were serving at Combat Outpost Keating in October 2009 were not. The Afghan troops were not. They were immediately they hid or they fled, and in some instances gave their weapons over to the Taliban. The Afghan National Army was of no use that day to the U.S., nor to their own self-defense.
Yes, I noticed that Staff Sergeant Romeshay at one point actually appropriated from one of the Afghan ANA troopers his sniper rifle.
Yeah, well, it wasn't being used, so Romeshay took it. Romeshay took it and made use of it. And he wasn't the only one. It's lucky that there were no incidents of Americans and Afghan soldiers actually hurting each other physically, because it almost came to it a couple times in the operation center. The Americans were so disgusted with the Afghan troops, and the Afghan troops were so eager to leave there were some intense moments there in the operation center where it looked like something really bad might happen, but ultimately it did not. It's not to say that all Afghan troops are like that. I mean, the book details ways in which there were some very brave Afghan troops serving there. But this battalion, there was something wrong with this battalion. Earlier that year, in a different part of the same area of operations, at an outpost called Bar-e-Ali, a similar situation happened where there was an overwhelming Taliban attack on an American outpost. This one was on top of a mountain, a much better place strategically. But the Afghans were able to infiltrate and kill 3 Americans and take a number of Afghan soldiers, prisoners of war, which was suspicious to a lot of Americans. But that was from the same battalion that a few months later were at a combat outpost Keating, suggesting that recruiting that year was rather subpar. But it's interesting. It was interesting to me to discover that some Afghan troops were actually quite good and quite admired by Americans. Unfortunately, not these, though.
Yes. So what happened to the survivors of Outpost Keating?
Well, I mean, I'm still in touch with a lot of them. After the outpost was attacked, you know, it was an intense battle. As you know, it's about a third of the book is about the attack itself. A very intense battle, but lasted from dawn till dusk. Eight U.S. troops killed and more than 20 men wounded. Afterwards, other than the ones who were wounded and needed to be treated, it was back to work. They went to the local forward operating base, Bostic, and started, you know, a new mission at a new base. And it was October, and they still had until May or June of 2010 before they could leave. So, I'm in touch with many of them still. Some of them are dealing with their memories and their experience better than others. They're heroes to a man. And, some of them have really bad post-traumatic stress disorder. Others seem to be dealing with it better. It depends in many ways on the support network they have and their experiences that day. There was one troop, Private Ed Faulkner Jr., who was basically told by the Army that he had to leave. He had a drug problem, which was not made any better by his post-traumatic stress disorder or the serious wound he got in Afghanistan on that day, and also a serious wound he got in Iraq a few years before. And Ed Faulkner's post-traumatic stress disorder was so bad that he spent much of 2010 descending into a world of misery and agony, and he overdosed on methadone within a year of the attack on Combat Outpost Keating. And one of the sergeants remarked to another fellow NCO that he thought Ed Faulkner Jr. was the ninth victim of Keating, and he didn't think he would be the last.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, it's really a shame. What's your next book? Anything in the works?
Oh no, I'm just started a new job at CNN. We're starting a new newscast. It's going to launch in March, and so I'm focused on that. And to be honest, it was such a big project and so long writing the Outpost that I'm trying to catch up with my wife and my boy and my girl. And I'm sure I'll write another book, but at this point it's tough to imagine anything that would motivate me as much as the Outpost did. So I guess I'll wait to see what happens. You know, in many ways I like to say that I didn't pick the Outpost. The Outpost picked me. I was in the hospital with my son on the day he was born. He was born a day before the Outpost was attacked, and I was in the hospital with him and my wife and my daughter, and I was holding my son that week, and I looked up and I saw this report on TV about this attack on Combat Outpost Keating, and it was just a very poignant moment where I was holding my son and hearing about eight other sons taken from this world. And there was just something in that moment that made me want to know more about who these eight men were who died, and why the Outpost was built at the bottom of three steep mountains, and who the 45 who survived were and what it was like. And it just set me on this journey. So it's going to be tough to replicate that, the feeling I had, the calling I felt to write the book, and then also the devotion I had to it. It's going to be difficult to repeat that.
Yes, indeed. And to everyone, I've been talking with Jake Tapper, the author of The Outpost, An Untold Story of American Valor, and it's an incredible book, and I do urge everyone to go out and take a look at it on Amazon or on the Outpost Facebook site. Jake, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on our show. Good luck in your new career at CNN, and I hope to be talking to you again in the future.
Sounds great. Thanks so much for having me.
Take care. Okay, Dale, are you there?
I am here. I'm just fascinated. I got to go quick run out to Barnes & Noble and get one.
Yeah, it is an absolutely incredible book. It's tough to put down. Jake did an absolute great service in telling that story. So we are approaching our break now.
We've had a couple of people call in with answers to your questions, but they have not been correct yet. So could you repeat the question, please?
I certainly will be happy to. When Major General A.P. Hill fought at Antietam, he was A, sick with a mild case of measles, B, a brigade commander, C, under arrest, or D, fighting on foot because his horse had been shot out from under him. The correct answer...
You're not telling. Not yet.
Not yet, but
we can eliminate one. Which one would you like to eliminate?
We can eliminate brigade commander. Eliminate
okay.
B.
Okay, so we've eliminated B. Come on, folks, you're down to three choices now. I'm sure you can pick that up. Give us a call, 877-573-7825, and we're going to be right back with Dwight's next guest after this message. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them. Specialist Roz McGinnis threw his back against a grenade thrown into his Humvee, saving the lives of his crewmates. Details after this.
It's pouring rain. It's still dark outside. Your heart starts beating really, really fast. You've never done anything so hard in your life. This is boot camp. This is the real thing now. It's such extreme pain, you don't understand how you can finish. I began to feel that there was no way I was ever going to have my title, U.S. Marine. It takes special inner strength, courage, and desire to do this. I was just thinking, I'm so close. I'm so close. And when I finished, I was like, I'm done. I did it. The moment I will never forget is when this drill instructor that I admire so much comes up to me straight in front of me, put her arm on my shoulder and said, good morning, Marine.
PFC Summer Volkman became a United States Marine. Can you? Call 1-800-MARINES. Maybe you could be one of the few and the proud.
On December 4th, 2006, McGinnis was manning the turret in the last Humvee of a six-vehicle patrol in northeast Baghdad when an insurgent threw a grenade from the roof of a nearby building. As he stood up to get ready to jump out of the vehicle, as he'd been trained to do, officials say McGinnis realized the other four soldiers in the vehicle did not know where the grenade had landed and did not have enough time to escape. He threw his back against the radio mount and smothered the explosive with his body. McGinnis was killed instantly, while the other four men survived. He was awarded the Medal of Honor posthumously by President Bush on June 2nd, 2008. The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
In this one small quiet moment, with the sky so free and clear, the sound of helicopter rotors brings a comfort to my ear. The water bag above my head rains a cleansing on my skin as I wash away the stains of war till it all begins again.
And we are back on Veterans Radio, and Dwight Zimmerman's got his At Ease program, and we're waiting for you folks out there to call in with your answers to the question to win a free copy of Dwight's book. So you can call us at 877-573-7825, and I'm going back to Dwight right now in our remote studio in Brooklyn, New York.
Thank you, Dale, and as I was listening to Russ McInnes' story, it's a really, his is a truly extraordinary account. I wrote about him in my book, Uncommon Valor, the Medal of Honor and the Warriors Who Earned It in Afghanistan and Iraq. So if you want to find out the full story about this kid who was a slacker in civilian life but found himself in the Army and then, of course, made the ultimate sacrifice to help his buddies, and in so doing got the posthumous Medal of Honor. His and the stories of all these other men form the book Uncommon Valor, and it's available at Amazon and in bookstores everywhere. Now, I would like to welcome my next guest here, who is Peter Larangis. Peter, are you there?
I'm here.
Oh, great. Did I pronounce your name correctly?
That was perfect. Thanks.
Oh, thank you. So, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, it's great to be here. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, yes. And now, you're the co-author of Somebody Please Tell Me Who I Am. So, I would like you to tell us a little bit about your collaborator, who, unfortunately, for medical reasons, we're not able to be able to interview him, and also tell us a little bit about the book.
Well, first of all, my collaborator was Harry Mazur, who is, I believe, 87 or 88, who served in World War II by lying about his age. I think he was 16, and was shot down over Czechoslovakia and was squirreled away into a barn by a farmer whose kids he later met, I think, in the 1990s, and who still remembered, you know, the being little kids when they brought him in. So Harry had a real mission in his life when he became a writer to talk about his experience, talk about the experience of young people in war and what it does to them. And his series of books that began with A Boy at War talked a lot about World War II and specifically the attack on Pearl Harbor. So Harry had an idea for a book, which he wanted to call Somebody Please Tell Me Who I Am. And he was going to write it, and it was going to be about a young man who enlists, goes to Iraq, gets involved in an IED explosion, and survives. But because of the effects on his brain, he completely loses his memory. He's got, very severe TBI and has to reconstruct his life from scratch. So Harry, when he was about to start the book, he had an outline and he had a ton of research, had a stroke. So all of a sudden, he, although the stroke was didn't leave him paralyzed, it had some unusual effects, he no longer could have the capacity to sort of see through the project of writing an entire book, and he had a lot of physical therapy. So all of a sudden, there was the risk of this book not being written. And Harry and I were very close friends, and our experiences are very different, but we bonded for years and years and years over writing, and he was kind of my mentor, like a father figure. And we have the same agent. And so the agent said, well, look, this is what happened to Harry. You know, I'm a little afraid that this book is just going to disappear, and it's a really important book. What would you think of finishing it? And I said, well, where do I sign up? So I started working on this book, and Harry, I took Harry's research and his experience. And at the time, my two nephews were about to graduate high school and were thinking about what they wanted to do with life, with their lives. And they really wanted to be in the military. They were twins. And so they're both right now, as we speak, in the ROTC. And I began, talking to them. And my experience was, my dad served in World War II and in the Pacific. And my nephews are now both in the ROTC. And I was too young. I was about a year or two too young for Vietnam. The war had ended by the time I was 18. So my experience was different. I was a peacetime guy, and surrounded sandwiched by two generations by people in the service. So I talked to my dad so much about his experience, and now all of a sudden I was talking to idealistic nephews about why from a pretty fairly affluent middle class town. But what was on their minds? And, of course, on my mind was also 9/11, because my son was on his fourth day of high school, four blocks from the World Trade Towers, when they came down. And I had to go down and find him, and I did. The proximity of that and the experience in the two different generations made me really think about what that meant, about, what sacrifice means, and why people want to do this, and how this is part of somebody's soul. And I thought that this book would be such a great way to investigate not only who this 18-year-old kid is and why he wants to do what he wants to do, but then who he is afterwards and how he puts his life together, and not only that, but what it means to the people around him, how it changes the lives of everybody when an incident like this happens to a young man. So the book starts, somebody please tell me who I am, it starts with him, and he's got a particular talent for performance, right? So he's a reluctant singing actor, and he's in a production of West Side Story, and lo and behold, he's really good. And everybody says to him, you got to do this. You got to get out there and perform. The world is waiting for you. And he doesn't want everybody to pigeonhole him. He doesn't want everyone else to define who he is. And what he wants to do is serve. And nobody can quite understand, what are you throwing away your life for? And he kind of thinks, well, it's not throwing away my life. There's a million people who can do what I do. This is what I want to do. And he goes and he says, hey, I'm just going to go to training. It's not such a big deal. And, of course, he gets sent over. And then the story goes from a kid saying, don't tell me who I am. I am who I am. To somebody who really has to figure out who he is from absolute zero. He doesn't remember a thing. The faces come in, he doesn't recall his mother, he doesn't recall his father, and now all of a sudden the community has to gather around him, and they have to figure out who he is too.
Yes, talk about the the IED event incident in which he is wounded, and those first days of recovery.
Yeah, so, excuse me. So, you know, the more research I did into into the explosions and reading about the experiences and talking to people about what happens to the brain when these kinds of things happen, I learned a lot. The different organs in the body react different ways to air pressure. And what doesn't react well, of course, is the brain, which is basically the consistency of, you know, of gelatin. And the brain kind of will react to air pressure by folding in on itself and, you know, changing shape and moving back out. And you just can't predict what's going to happen. You know, the same two people can be in the proximity of an IED explosion and have two completely different results. Somebody may be totally fine, you know, aside from the physical effects. I mean, if you're, you know, that's a whole other story. But in this case, this kid was shielded from the physical effects pretty much. But what really affected him was the fact that his brain had just completely short-circuited. So he could get physical therapy, and fortunately had his limbs, and fortunately could learn to walk and, you know, function again. But the memory cells completely wiped out.
Yes, you have a website I see here, and could you tell people where people can about this website and where they can get the book?
So my website is just my name, peterlaranges.com, P-E-T-E-R. Can I spell my name? Yes, L-E-R-A-N-G-I-S.com. And on it I've got all sorts of information and places where you can order the book. I was honored just a few weeks ago. Harry and I were both honored, of course, by the fact that the book won an award from the American Library Association for the best book for teens depicting adversity and reactions to it. So we were both really proud of that.
Yes, I see that. I've got the page up on my computer, and congratulations. This is a wonderful honor. Now, I have to say, too, that I was very impressed with the book designer that you had on the book. I'm looking right now at page 83. It's a sheet called Memory Book, Ben Bright, who is the protagonist in the story. And it's just a simple series of questions. My name is, my home is in the town of, my mother's name is, and so on. And all we see here is just some scrawls of a person trying to write, and obviously it's just not coming out.
Yeah, well, one of the things that happens when you're recovering from brain trauma like that is you keep what they call a memory book, and you keep trying to fill it as you're making progress, so that when you look back, you can see where you've been and how far you've come. And so this is Ben's very first attempt to fill in anything. And he doesn't get very far. I mean, it's basic. So you also, as a reader, as you're following Ben along and you're following along his family, and he begins to have more and more awareness, you see the handwriting on the memory book improving. At the very beginning, when he first comes into consciousness and doesn't know where he is, that was a tough thing to portray, because, you know, you've got a character who at the beginning of the book, you know, is smart and he's funny and, you know, he's got a girlfriend and a best friend, and, you know, he can sort of, you know, he just functions like a normal person. And all of a sudden, you know, as a writer, you're writing about somebody who doesn't recognize anything, who could barely, you know, who cannot speak and can hear things but not necessarily comprehend them. It's a very hard thing to do. So at the beginning of the book, you've got the scrawl in the memory book, but I've got a chapter where Ben is coming into consciousness and all he can't see anything, and all he can do is hear. So it's a chapter that's just it's just dialogue. You don't know who's saying what. It's just quote after quote after quote after quote, which is what you would experience when you're just coming out of consciousness.
Yes, so, sorry, Peter. I have to cut you off here. We're approaching our break. And so if you could, again, please quickly tell our listeners the book and where they can get it.
Okay, sure. It's Somebody Please Tell Me Who I Am. It's published by Simon & Schuster. It's available at all bookstores, available online, and at my own website, peterlaranges.com.
Thank you so much, Peter. And this is really a powerful book, everyone. I urge you to go to his site, peterlaranges.com, find out more. It is a wonderful and very moving story, very effective. Peter, what's your latest project? You've got to be working on something new.
I'm working on something completely different, an action-adventure series called The Seven Wonders, which just made its debut this week as number 5 on the New York Times Children's Bestseller list. So I'm actually in the middle of a 15-city tour right now going out and promoting that book.
Oh, okay. I've just been told by our producer that we have a little bit of extra time, but we need to get our break and our trivia question answered, let's hope. So if you could just stay with me.
Sure.
Thank you. Okay, Dale?
Okay, you are listening to Veterans Radio, and we'll be right back after this message with our prize winner. You're listening to Veterans Radio.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
We're back on Veterans Radio, and Dwight, we do have a winner coming up here on the line.
Okay, great.
And joining me on the line right now is Kurt Kosmowski from Northville, Michigan. And Kurt, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, good morning.
So, Dwight, you want to read that question again, and then I'll have Kurt give his answer.
Okay, welcome, Kurt. And here is the question again. When Major General A.P. Hill fought at Antietam, he was A, sick with a mild case of measles, B, a brigade commander, C, under arrest, or D, fighting on foot because his horse had been shot out from under him. And, Kurt, the answer is?
Under arrest.
You are correct, sir.
Oh, we need our cheering music.
There we go.
All right. All right. Thank you very much, Kurt. And we're going to get that book out to you. Nina's already gotten your name and address. And what station do you listen to Veterans Radio on?
AM 990.
Okay, 990 WDEO.
I can't take full credit for getting the answer right. Actually, our teen son is very interested in history, and he provided the answer.
Okay. And what is his name?
His name is Aaron.
A-A-R-O-N?
A-A-R-O-N.
Okay, so okay. Dwight, make sure you include his name in your signing of the book.
Got it.
All right. Thank you very much, Kurt, and thanks for listening to Veterans Radio.
Thank you. We listen to the show often. Thank you both for serving.
Thank you. Thank you. All right, Dwight, let's go back and continue your interview with Peter. I find this book to really be fascinating. Peter, I'm anxious to read it myself and how you and your partner came up with this idea, because it sounds like it's a real story, but it's fiction, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, it's interesting because it's a little bit like art imitating life, because all of a sudden now Harry had Harry's mm-hmm. brain was not where it used to be, and so our collaboration had to change obviously after his stroke. And, you know, Harry's original plan for the book had a much, much different ending where Ben, the boy who has the trauma, you know, recovers and creates a haven with his friends where they kind of escape from reality. And the more research I did into this kind of TBI and this level of it, it became clear to me that this is a long road back. And it, you know, he's not going to get to that point in the book right away, if ever. So I had to, you know, I had to really be real. I had to be realistic to what happens to people, and I didn't want to, you know, create an ending that was too much of a fantasy. But I still wanted to create hope because, you know, you do make progress, and people do continue to be loyal to you and love you and try the best they can. And that's.
Yes. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned that ending because I found it to be, now I'm not going to give it away or anything, but I found it to be a very poignant and startling ending. It was not something that I actually expected, I have to say, and I was very impressed with how the sensitivity and eloquence that you did in that last chapter.
Thanks very much. I really appreciate that. It was a very tough thing to write. In fact, I didn't know when I was writing it that I was at the ending. It was interesting. It was coming up on dinner one night, and I'm working on this book, and I'm thinking to myself, how am I gonna get to the ending? You know, what am I gonna do? I didn't really know. And all of a sudden, I wrote those words, and I put my hands down, and I said, oh yeah, that's it. That's it. You know, time for dinner. No, it really wasn't about that.
I think you writers always seem to have that thing. It's how is it going to end? And then it suddenly ends, and you go, oh, that's it. Okay, I'm
right.
Done.
Yeah, yeah. And the key piece is time to eat.
Yeah. Yes. I understand exactly what you're talking about because in my books, well, most of them have been nonfiction. But it's still very similar because, you know, even when you're telling stories about an account that actually existed, you have to structure it in a way that you know, have an ending. And sometimes they just pop up in ways unexpected. I trust you probably went through three or four different drafts of...
Yeah, by the time I was at the end of the book, my drafts were on the floor. Hey, you know, and Dwight, I mean, what you're doing is telling a story too, nonfiction or fiction. You've got an obligation to your readers to tell it in a way that's going to bring them along. You can't just recite facts. So I know exactly where you're coming from, and with your nonfiction books too. One of the interesting things writing this book was, you know, when I was writing about the brain. I didn't really intend to have a brother character who was autistic, and he kind of just came out of the, you know, ether to me and said, you know, I need to be in this book. It's funny how that kind of thing happens. And in the book, without giving away what happens at the end, in the book, there's not only this stuff happening with Ben, but Ben's got a brother who's a pretty high-functioning spectrum autistic kid, very smart, but, you know, he's got to have constant care, right? So that he kind of gets second, you know, place now to his brother, who's got such a condition. And what happens is, in trying to bridge that gap, you know, between a brother who can't remember anybody and another brother whose mind is structured in a very, very strict kind of way, the two of them draw closer even though you don't notice it during the book, and at the end. It's the communication between those two exceptional brains that results in what happens at the end of the book.
Yes, that was a... I got blindsided by that, I have to say. It was fascinating because I do know a family that has a number of kids with Asperger's.
Yeah.
And so I recognized what this was in the story. And to see how the relationship between the brothers evolved and matured, and it was very effective.
Oh, thanks.
Well, I want to thank Peter, for bringing out the idea of the TBI, because that seems to be the signature wound that so many of these men and women are coming back with.
Right.
And that we have to be really a cognizant of it and be aware of the time period it's going to take for them to recover as much as they possibly can.
Right, and the care and the sacrifice with the families, because in so many cases, there are only a few places that are qualified to deal with some of the levels of TBI. And you got a family who's living in, you know, who knows, right, Louisiana or Illinois or Indiana, and the place where they have to go is Stanford, California. Well, you know, the family that then has to either have extraordinary plane fares or has to move, and, you know, jobs become affected and houses have to be reconstructed and lives are affected. And, you know, and we need to really think about how do we support this and how serious it is to so many people. And as you say, how long it takes, sometimes maybe an entire lifetime, to bring somebody back.
Wow.
Yeah, it's an extraordinary commitment that families have to make, and a sacrifice. And you know, that is very effectively stated in your book. All I can say is, you know, thank you for writing such a moving and powerful book. And please tell Harry how much I appreciated what he did, you know, in putting this thing together.
Harry, Harry's the real hero, and Harry's the one who came up with this idea, and I will make sure that Harry hears this because he will be very, very proud, and I'll definitely convey your wishes to him. He's an amazing man.
Yeah, thank you. And if you could just recap the title and where people can get it again, please.
It's called Somebody Please Tell Me Who I Am, and it's available at any bookstore or any online seller, and also at my website, peterlaranges.com. And it's published by Simon & Schuster.
Yes. Peter, again, thank you so much for being on our show, and good luck in your future projects. And
thank
hope
you.
To have you back.
Great. It was great to talk to you.
Thank you very much, Peter.
All right, take care.
You too.
All right. Dwight, I got to get that one.
Yes,
I'm going to get
do.
Both of these now. That's just something else to add to my reading list, right?
I'm sure your wife is just going to be thrilled with two more books there.
Yes, every time the FedEx truck drives by, she goes, oh, he's gone and bought another one, isn't he? But it's worth it. And Dwight, I want to thank you really very much for putting together this program for today. Dwight has a monthly program on Veterans Radio called At Ease, where he interviews many of his friends, it sounds like, which is great when you have that mutual admiration society going out there, and it's a pleasure for us to have you on Veterans Radio and to do that with us.
Oh, thank you. It's an honor to be here, and thank you, everyone, for listening. Looking forward to being on here next month from Studio 4F.
That's the one, Studio 4F in Brooklyn, New York. Yeah. All right, Dwight, thanks. Hang on the line. I want to talk to you after the program, but I want to remind our audience out there to please put Vance McCrum, a dog man, in your prayers. He is recovering from that car accident on Thursday at the University of Toledo Hospital, and he really could use those prayers. If you want to send him a message, you can send an email to me, dale@veteransradio.net, and I will make sure that he gets that message. Next week on Veterans Radio, we've got two possibilities. Number one, we're going to look at the very, very last days in Vietnam, not when they're taking people out of the embassy, but those last battles with our veterans over there, and so I'm anxious to do that one. We're also going to take a look at some of the other things that are going on in the world of veterans. So until next week, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or this station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.